right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I am Scott Horton, and this is the Republic Broadcasting Network. Now, George Bush is the catastrophic success, and that comes from his description of the war in Iraq, a catastrophic success. And I should, in fairness, let you know that the next day his press secretary came out and said, well, the president is a plain-spoken man, and what he means is that the war in Iraq was so successful that we destroyed their nation-state so quickly that the army just fell apart and melted back into the civilian population. And, of course, see, that's who's shooting at us now. It's all the old army guys. And so that's a great excuse. But the fact of the matter is the Americans fired the Iraqi army. That's why they melted back into the civilian population. And no, that's not the bulk of who we're fighting in Iraq right now. So what a bunch of lies all the way around. I use the phrase catastrophic success to describe this president because he has been quite successful at creating catastrophe. Now, you put aside the entire bogus war on terrorism, which we'll talk about that definition here in a minute with our guests, but you put aside the war on terrorism and the war on Iraq, and just look at Bush's domestic policy and ask yourself whether this measures up to your definition of a conservative president. First of all, he did his best to delay and obstruct the September 11th commission over and over and over again. He put tariffs on steel, raising the price of your car and anything else you buy made out of metal. Put tariffs on furniture and on coal. He signed Ted Kennedy's No Child Left Behind Act with great fanfare and talked about it for, you know, what, 35 minutes or something in his speech the other night, bragging about what a great thing it is that he's nationalizing education more than any other president. He signed a farm bill that would make Vladimir Lenin blush for the amount of subsidy sent to farmers, and really not to farmers, but to the agribusiness distribution companies, who surely will go out of business without our welfare. He's promised new job training and housing. His tax cut has been minuscule and counterproductive with a $2.5 trillion budget where they just tax you through inflation anyway by devaluing your bank account. And he said in the other night, he actually had the nerve to say, I've been restraining spending. That's an exact quote from his speech Thursday night. This is a man who has not vetoed a single bill. The only thing he threatened to veto was when the Congress said that they were going to try to take parts out of the Patriot Act. Other than that, he's signed every little thing. He's created this Department of Homeland Security, which is a constitutional monstrosity and employs over 300,000 people. The only useful purpose they've served so far is to give us color-coded cries of wolves coming to get us. He nationalized airport security and bailed out the airlines. That's very conservative. He has more secrecy than any other president. He consistently refused and delayed and obstructed the arming of airline pilots. And even after he was forced to give in by even some Democrats in Congress, they have still dragged their feet and not armed the pilots. The Bush administration brags about vigorously enforcing gun laws, including Project Exile, where they turn any local gun crime into a federal crime. He has expanded the drug war and seizure of people's property. He deliberately betrayed his promise to respect states' rights when it comes to medical pot that he ran on in his campaign of the year 2000. He has, of course, attempted to suspend habeas corpus. He has put two American citizens in Navy brigs. His administration was responsible for the Total Information Awareness and the TIPS program, all of which are eerily reminiscent of Nazi Germany. He has done the biggest Medicare expansion since that socialist Lyndon Johnson. He proposed last week eliminating 527s, which are the only legal outlet left for the American people to run ads against politicians they hate. And let's see, he wants to expand the FTAA, billions of dollars in no bid contracts for Halliburton, and he's raised Al-Qaeda recruitment through the roof. So there's your wonderful catastrophic success of a president, George W. Bush. Everybody go vote Republican. You know you love it. A All right, everybody. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and our guest this hour is Elaine Castle. She's an attorney and professor of law at Concord and Marymount Universities. She's the chair of the American Bar Association's Behavioral Sciences Committee. She writes for Fine Law and has a weblog called Civil Liberties Watch at citypages.com. She's also the author of the great new book, The War on Civil Liberties, How Bush and Ashcroft Have Dismantled the Bill of Rights. Welcome to the show, Elaine. Hello, hello, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, there you are. And how are you today?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing great. I really love your book. I didn't get a chance to finish it, but I read a whole bunch of it.
Good.
And I really liked it, but... well, and I should tell everybody, I interviewed Mrs. Castle before on my old radio show. And Elaine, because you and I already get along, I want to start out this interview by picking a fight with you.
Okay.
If that's okay with you.
Sure.
In your description of the Bill of Rights, I'm afraid you miss not just a major point, but the major point about the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that it is a list of restrictions. It is not a grant of freedom to anyone. It is a list of, and in fact, this is from the preamble to the Bill of Rights, it is a list of declaratory and restrictive clauses in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers by the national government. This is a government created by people who were born naturally, self-evidently free, and they allowed this government to exist on the condition that Congress shall not this and may not that. And that is the Bill of Rights. So to say that it gives freedom to people, I believe, is a serious misnomer and one that, in fact, gives more legitimacy to people like George Bush and John Ashcroft who are trying to destroy it.
That's a nice way of framing it. I like that.
Oh, well, good. Thank you very much. I was kind of hoping you would fight with me about it, but I guess not.
No, I think that's a good way of saying it. I mean, the way the Bill of Rights came about, as you're well aware, is when it came time to sign the Constitution, George Mason from Virginia and others realized that there were no rights reserved to the people, that the Constitution was totally a grant of power to the different branches of government. So, well, what about us, he said. And thus we got the first 10 amendments to the Constitution that's known as the Bill of Rights.
And I think actually we would all probably be better served if it was referred to as the Bill of Restrictions.
That's right, I like that too. That's interesting, yeah.
Okay, there you go. Okay, now let's get to the questions. Now, I love the way you start this book, and this is something that I was going to talk about a minute ago, and then I remembered I wanted to wait and talk to you about. You begin this book with a few quotes where basically you seem to be attacking the idea that we're fighting a war against terrorism. So I would like for you to explain what you mean.
Well, I guess the interesting place to start is that about the only truth that came out of the lips of George Bush or any of his cabal this week was when he made the mistake, as he said, of saying that the war on terror probably could not be won. Nothing truer could have been said, because the war on terror, I mean, if one were to frame it correctly, as the 9/11 panel suggested, you would say that it's a war on a tactic. Or it's a war against radicalism and extremism that targets innocent civilians in order to make a political point or to extract political action. And as such, we know that human beings have used terrorism as long as there have been human beings and ideologies and nationalism. And so what really is at stake today is in its present form that the United States is concerned with is probably Islamic radicalism. In Russia, they're concerned with Chechen radicalism and other things. And so you can't have a war on a noun and thereby call unto yourself all of the war powers of the Constitution. Create budgets to fight a war against an enemy that doesn't have an army, doesn't have a name. It's a tactic. The thing that is so incredible to me is how this whole line about the war on terror has been adopted by, of course, all the media, and even by John Kerry, by everyone. And no one stops to question, what are we really talking about? Certainly we might be fighting, you know, radicalism and things of that, you know. Violence. But
how about a war against Al Qaeda? That might actually
have a
definition.
That would do, and that's why in Afghanistan, that would do. In Afghanistan, was certainly a point, but of course, what's going on now, that doesn't fit when you try to use the war in Iraq as an extension of the war on terror, because then you have to call the Iraqi, quote, insurgents, who have their own national interest at stake, you have to call them terrorists. So you see, anybody, the demonstrators are terrorists or potential terrorists. That's why they're thrown into pens, which I find incredibly offensive. I don't know why most people don't seem to be talking about that, but the way demonstrators, protesters were treated last week in New York City is absolutely appalling. All in the name of potential, stopping potential terrorists, because we're in a war on terror. And as the courts have said, when they have given their blanket protections and their recognition of Bush's claim to be a wartime president, they say, yeah, well, you know, the war on terror is fought in every street, in every building, in every corner of the world. Now, once you adopt that premise, then the potential for martial law, for the suspension of habeas corpus, for incredible incursions, more so on civil liberties than we have seen already, become acceptable. So the more you use the word, and now you rarely hear anyone question the term anyway, but now it's become absolutely rote. Everybody says that it just rolls off the tongue, and people don't even know what they're talking about.
Yeah, it's sort of the thing where any objection that you can raise, they say, well, but it's wartime.
Oh, absolutely. We are at war. Now, is that all you heard last week?
Yeah.
That's all.
Oh,
I
heard
that's about
a promise for a clinic in every neighborhood.
Oh, excuse me, what was that?
I said, yeah, I heard nothing but that and a promise for a clinic in every neighborhood.
Oh, yeah, right.
You point out in your book, Elaine, that Chief Justice William Rehnquist has actually written a book about how there are no limits to war powers.
Right. And apparently there are very few, and the irony of that was written a year before, you know, September 11th, and the name of the book is No Law, No Law But One, All Laws But One, Whether, and that the only law that is not suspendable by the president during wartime is the writ of habeas corpus, the right to petition governments, and that writ supposedly has to be suspended by the Congress, but of course we know that the Bush administration did make every effort to suspend the writ of habeas corpus until the Supreme Court slapped their hands this summer and said that they couldn't quite go that far. Once you say war, I mean, everything goes, right? You can't protest the budget that's allegedly for, you know, $87 billion for the war in Iraq, because the war in Iraq is now a front in the war on terror. You can't complain about terror alerts that shut down businesses and traffic in Washington, D.C. You know, I can't complain about that. What? Are you a terrorist, right? Is that what you want? Terrorism? Is that, you know? So it's the great, I mean, since September 11th, which someone referred to not long ago as the gift that keeps on giving, we certainly saw that this week. There's nothing that can't be done in the name of September 11th, but so too can nothing can be criticized or condemned if you attribute it to the war on terror.
You say in your book, Elaine, that if it's true they hate us for our freedom, they have much less reason to hate us now. And I was just going to add to that, it's too bad they hate us for our intervention and now have more reason than ever to hate us.
Well, absolutely. In fact, the thing that's so incredible is that, well, not that they care, but that, you know, the Bush administration seems not to, at least publicly, realize how far they're driving the have-nots in the world to extremism because of our tactics abroad. I mean, not to mention at home. I mean, now that we've taken our war on terror abroad and used that, let's say, as an excuse for prison abuse in Abu Ghraib. You understand? I mean, if you heard, you know, all the talk about that was, oh, we're in a war on terror. We're in a different kind of war. I mean, you know, we arrested 7,000 people. You know, we can't be bothered with, you know, taking care of them because it's a different kind of war. So,
well, and that's even what they said in the Department of Justice memo justifying it legally, right?
Absolutely. They justified interrogation tactics. They justified abuse. They justified torture, all because this is, quote, a different kind of war. So, you see, that's the excuse at home. for the, you know, things like the Patriot Act and all manner of regulations under the Homeland Security Act. And now the thing that I think will drive the rest of the world to further hate us is that we will use that tactic all over the world, wherever we happen to be. So that's the, so in other words, that suspends all conventional rules of war or expectations as to the laws of war. Because, hey, all bets are off. We've created a new kind of war.
And it's sort of interesting that it even matters what new laws they pass if the rule of law doesn't really mean anything anyway.
Well, I think that's an excellent point. And once you go down that slippery slope of saying that, you know, realizing also how the lawyers in the Justice Department and the White House go to such great lengths to try to weasel out of any existing law, then you're right, it doesn't matter. Although when you consider that the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act and the regulations enacted thereunder give the government such sweeping powers, they already have, in a sense, created a law unto themselves that it's not likely that they would suspend. You know, I mean, that they were likely more to extend it. But it is true that any existing law can be written out of the books, according to them.
It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and the guest is Elaine Castle. We're talking about the death of the rule of law and the American Constitution, and her new book, The War on Civil Liberties, How Bush and Ashcroft Have Dismantled the Bill of Rights. We'll be right back. Alright everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I am Scott Horton, and the guest is Elaine Castle. She's the author of the new book, The War on Civil Liberties, How Bush and Ashcroft Have Dismantled the Bill of Rights. And if you're just tuning in and you missed the beginning and you want to go back and listen to this or any of my previous interviews on the Weekend Interview Show, just go to weekendinterviewshow.com, and I keep all the archives there. Alright, Elaine, back to business here. The war against the Bill of Rights really starts with the USA Patriot Act, correct?
Yeah, well, it started really before that under Clinton with the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which was a response in part to the Oklahoma City bombing. And that really laid the foundation. That made a lot of changes and created the secret court we know as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Action Court, the FISA Court.
Well, I thought the FISA Court was created in the 70s.
Well, it got a new iteration in the 1996 Act because it created investigations for domestic terrorism as coming under their purview. Before that, it was just for foreign intelligence reasons. And so it was expanded to include domestic surveillance for terrorism. And that was something no one, you know, paid a whole lot of attention to at the time.
Because you make the point in your book that in 1996, when they passed this law, anything that's a terrorist act was already a crime.
Oh, exactly. And so that was really done more for, you know, political reasons, as so much of so many laws are, especially with a name like that. And in fact, the more significant portion of that law was the suspension of many of the laws of appeals and habeas corpus as they related to death penalty cases, and thus the rather macabre title, Effective Death Penalty Act. Effective meaning to stop appeals as much as possible. So that was, of course, a great political capital from that.
So then all the things that Congress wouldn't let Clinton keep in that bill ended up being incorporated into the Patriot Act.
Well, exactly. And not only that, but there were, you know, according to the people who had the hand in writing the Patriot Act, there was a wish list that, you know, government lawyers and law enforcement had forever, that only they waited for an opening. If they could get in there and do away with things like the pesky Fourth Amendment, you know, that protects us supposedly from unreasonable searches and seizures, that would be an awfully nice thing. And so it was a great power grab done, you know, in six weeks, with little debate. Almost no one in Congress had read it. before they signed it. Of course, that's probably not unusual, but in this case, it was fatal. However, anybody who voted against it, the lone dissenter among the Senate was Senator Russell Feingold, and of course, he got a lot of flack. And as you recall, the little discussion that there was, John Ashcroft was up on the Hill saying that anyone who voted against it would be literally inviting another terrorist attack. The Patriot Act and its progeny, the, you know, all the regulations in the Homeland Security Act, if all were in effect on September 11th, would not have stopped September 11th. And as we know now from reading the September 11th Commission report, for all its flaws, it has some wonderful, wonderful commentary in there and wonderful facts. September 11th happened for many reasons, but mainly because the government didn't do its job. It was a gross and colossal failure at all levels of our government.
And nothing in the Patriot Act would have helped them do that.
Absolutely not. They talk about how, oh, well, the reason why, you know, the FBI didn't let the CIA know that, you know, some of the hijackers were here was because there was, quote, a wall, you know, we've heard that, a wall between the two agencies. Well, that's not true at all. That's just that was just an excuse to further write into the law what had already been policy, and that was sharing of information between the FBI and CIA in cases of domestic terrorism. So as so much, you know, so much that comes out of the Bush administration, I think it'd be hard for me to even find one truth a day that comes out of that White House. But that one, the lie about that is, you know, again, sort of like urban myth. You know, at September 11th, among other things, and one of the major flaws was the immigration. I mean, as you recall, I mean, they were the men, the hijackers, were either on fraudulent visas or on student visas that had long since, after they had long since ceased to be students. And as you remember, I teach a course in immigration law, and we say, well, September 11th didn't change immigration law, but March of 2002 did. That was when, if you recall, when the immigration authorities issued permanent visas for several of the deceased hijackers. Do you remember that?
Government.
You remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, I mean, just, you know, just and of course, you know, let's not mention the fact that they got through security and that they had been, you know, stopped two or three times and gone through metal detectors two or three occasions. And so the Patriot, I mean, what the Patriot Act has done is made it easier for the, made it possible for the law enforcement to suspend, you know, the fourth, well, I say all the way, first, fourth, fifth, sixth, and eighth amendments at a minimum. So,
and
for
it would have got rid of the ninth and tenth, except they never existed.
Right, or they, you know, if they couldn't get, and the second, well, you know,
they're taking care of that
arms,
in other ways.
You got trouble with the Second Amendment because John Ashcroft is such a, you know, such a believer in the right to bear arms.
Oh, well, I'd have to contradict
right.
You there. He brags about Project Exile and all that.
Oh, well,
yeah,
if it can be used
laws.
To put people away, right, yeah.
All right, well, hang tight, Elaine. We're going to break. We'll be right
all
back.
Right.
It's the Weekend Interview Show on the Republic Broadcasting Network.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
I wear it for another 100,000 who have died, believing that we all were on their side. Well, there's things that never will be right, I know, and things need changing everywhere you go. But till we start to make a move to make a few things right, you'll never see me wear.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and the guest this hour is Elaine Castle. She writes for Find Law and also has a great blog called Civil Liberties Watch. Her new book is called The War on Civil Liberties, How Bush and Ashcroft Have Dismantled the Bill of Rights. Now, Elaine, you write in your book that the enemy combatant status that has been applied to Hamdi and Padilla is found nowhere in the Patriot Act or any other law. So if that's the case, where does it come from?
Well, it came from a distortion of the laws of war, the traditional laws of war, that allow governments to hold combatants who are not in uniform, but who are indeed fighting, you know, against you know, the holding party, to hold them and try them for crimes or turn them over after the end of hostilities. And so the Bush administration adopted the term enemy combatant to be used upon people that they decided might be fighting, first of all, in Afghanistan with the Taliban, and to do something quite remarkable, which is remove them from the field of battle and bring them over, you know, to foreign territory, Cuba, which that they thought would keep them from being subject to the laws of the United States. And actually,
so the plan was, from the White House's point of view, to make them where they're not prisoners of war, and yet they're not suspected felons either.
Absolutely.
So they can just hold them indefinitely.
To have them in absolutely what's called a legal black hole, where no law applies to them whatsoever. And not only to the people in Guantanamo, but to Americans that the United States wished to name enemy combatants, and make them totally non-reachable by the rule of law. An incredible, if you can think about it, for any country, I mean, what do we think of when we think that there's no law that applies to a typical situation?
Cops in black come and get you in the middle of the night.
Absolutely.
And off you go.
I mean that to me, that is the most striking thing that the Bush administration has done, is to try to create a status of people that are outside the reach of any law whatsoever. I find that to be absolutely stunning.
Yeah, I mean, the only people who are supposed to be completely out of reach of the law are the government. But the law is supposed to still protect us. Right,
and of course, you know, I think that what your listeners need to know, and I wrote about this right after the Supreme Court rendered its decisions in the cases of Hamdi and Padilla, which was a non-decision, and the Guantanamo prisoners. Since that decision was rendered in June, it's only this past week that the Defense Department has allowed lawyers to visit some of those Guantanamo prisoners that the Supreme Court ruled had the right to have access to the court. You know, so that's from June till September. And the Pentagon absolutely just stonewalled and wouldn't let attorneys in there. And now they've only let a handful in there. So no actions have
been filed. Well,
plus
they're spying on all the lawyers as they're talking to their clients, too, right?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, any lawyer who goes to Guantanamo is having every contact with the clients is videotaped and audiotaped. They have to go through body cavity searches. If they want to represent anyone, they have to acquire and pay for their own security clearances, which, of course, there's your little snag right there, because how long does it take to get a security clearance? 6 months, a year, maybe more. And so the rules, and there are attorneys that I'm involved with who are demanding from the federal courts that they not allow the Pentagon to enforce those rules. But, you know, the court, this is in the D.C., federal court in D.C., is absolutely dragging its feet because it's in no hurry, right? I mean, it's in no hurry to decide these cases and doesn't want to embarrass the president, I suppose, before the election. And so justice is far from being done, even though the Supreme Court made not a radical decision, but one saying, sure, you know, let the men file their petitions, right? I mean, come on.
Yeah, all we have to do is just turn them down.
Oh, which is exactly what will happen. But the incredible thing, I mean, nothing amazes me anymore, but that Rumsfeld and Ashcroft worked together to create rules and restrictions so that the lawyers could not even actually get there still to see their clients, to my mind, just shows you how far this administration will go. Just because the Supreme Court orders something will happen is far from saying that this administration is going to abide by the mandate of the Supreme Court. I mean, they don't. They have not yet. And who's going to find them in contempt of court? Only the Supreme Court could do so. And that's only been done one time in the history of the court, a finding of contempt.
Right. Was that Andrew Jackson saying you made the law, now let's see you enforce it?
Well, it sounds like it, doesn't it? I mean, I think that this administration, I mean, because I think it was, you know, they thought that they had a slam dunk on these cases before the Supreme Court. When you go back and you hear, now, let me just interject something. I'm sorry I'm interrupting myself, but I just have to let your listeners know what went on in the Hamdi case or what's about to happen. For more than two years, Yasser Hamdi's been held incommunicado without access to a lawyer. And on no charges, right? Enemy combatant, but he hasn't committed a crime. We haven't charged him with anything. And the Supreme Court ruled that he had the right to file a petition for habeas corpus. overruling, you know, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond. Well, guess what's going on even as we speak? The government is planning to release him, on the condition that he go to Saudi Arabia. He has Saudi Arabian citizenship as well as American citizenship. And that's it. That's it, okay?
So
the man that the Supreme Court, that the Bush administration said was so dangerous that he couldn't even have a lawyer, that he couldn't be tried in a court because it would be a risk of national security. And not only that, but the argument was made to that effect to the Supreme Court in April of this year. Suddenly, in August, that man is going to be set free. Now, what do you think about that?
Well, I think he must not have been so dangerous that he deserved to be held in the naval brig.
Absolutely.
Either that or they flipped him and they want to use him to try to infiltrate some Al-Qaeda types in Saudi
Arabia. Well, you know, that's a possibility too. But it's a stunning reversal, is it not? And then also, you know, pay attention to what happened in the Detroit last week, a case that I write about in my book, the first terrorist cell in the United States case that went to trial, went to do a jury. The judge has reversed the convictions at the request of John Ashcroft because the evidence against the men was exposed as a fraud on many fronts, more than one piece of evidence. And there, that is one of the cases, you know, hear about.
And they
Ashcroft.
Were convicted of the under the Patriot Act?
They were convicted of terrorism. They were convicted of aiding and abetting terrorism and conspiring to commit acts of terrorism. And one of the pieces of evidence involved a government witness who said that he overheard them, you know, in a holding cell in a prison, you know, in a jail, and talking about what they were planning to do. That witness turned out to be a fraud. Another was a tape that was supposedly a CD-ROM that was alleged to contain all kinds of, you know, surveillance cameras and things like that. And the only thing that had on it was a family vacation, you know, Disney World or some such. Interestingly, during that case, John Ashcroft was criticized at least three times by the judge for speaking publicly about the case when the judge, Judge Rosen, had put a gag order on everyone. And one day the judge walked into the court and he held the newspaper in his hands, the Detroit paper, and where, you know, Ashcroft was talking about what a wonderful witness they had who was going to testify, you know, for the government. And the judge said to the prosecutor, you better get this message to John Ashcroft. He is amenable to my orders as well. He continued, Ashcroft, to talk about the case. Even after the judge threatened to find him in contempt of court. Of course, now you have, again, like you said, you have a problem with our wonderful separation of powers, so that if John Ashcroft wants to thumb his nose at a federal judge, there's not a whole lot a federal judge can do. But in any event, all during that case, I was in contact with lawyers involved in it, and they knew that the government was hiding evidence and was lying about the evidence, but the judge ruled in favor of the government every time, saying, I've got to give the government the edge in the war on terror, right?
I'm really looking forward to my kangaroo court trial.
Well, yeah.
Maybe I'll have a star chamber and three military judges.
I don't even know if they'll have a trial for you and me next year, because I think when George Bush is, you know, re-anointed, and I'm afraid he'll be, you know, I don't want to say elected, but he'll become president again. I think that there will be political prisoners. I think people will be arrested. I think there will be Americans in Guantanamo and who knows where. I mean, I absolutely believe that there's going to be a crackdown, and it started already with, you know, not only the demonstrators, but do you know there have been, of what I know of, at least a dozen arrests of people who are doing nothing more than standing in a T-shirt or a placard near George Bush during this campaign.
Oh, they're violating the free speech zone.
Absolutely.
Perimeter.
Yes. I mean, if Americans, I mean, well, aren't getting it, can you imagine what's going to happen if he's a president for four more years?
It's the Weekend Interview Show. The guest is Elaine Castle. She's the author of the book, The War on Civil Liberties, How Bush and Ashcroft Have Dismantled the Bill of Rights. On page 122 in your book, you talk about a Canadian citizen who was taken to Syria for an extraordinary rendition. Mm-hmm. What is that?
Well, there's an even worse case, too, of an American citizen. But this is a rendition is what the CIA does when it takes someone off of any street anywhere in the world and puts them anywhere they want to. Either they kill them, they kidnap them, and up until this case, I don't believe there had ever been any public admission by the CIA that they actually do engage in what they call renditions. Now, everyone knew they did it, but they didn't come out and say it. And
so what makes a rendition extraordinary?
Well, I think that's what they call it. I mean, they call it, that's just a term that the CIA uses. And they're saying that they have some, you know, tremendous reason to get someone either, they do it, they may bring a foreign citizen to the United States by way of kidnapping in order to bring them to trial. In this particular case, no one has a clue as to why this Canadian citizen was taken off of a plane in New York and sent to Syria, where he was held for months, until the Syrians sent him back to the Canadians. The Canadian government, it turns out later, of course, was complicit with the United States in sending him to Syria. He was supposedly being questioned about vague acts of terrorism, but they found nothing on him. There's nothing. He's now suing the U.S. government for that.
Well, and isn't it interesting, too, that Syria would be cooperating with him?
I
thought they were part of the axis of evil or something.
You know
what
I've decided? Listen, I've decided that we can't believe anything, that probably no one is the enemy of the United States, because the United States is so powerful. Everybody wants something from us or is afraid of us. And I have gotten so cynical that when I hear something about like that, you know, about, you know, Syria being our enemy, I think if we were to take some action against Syria, I almost think it would probably be with the, you know, with the assent of the Syrian government in order to accomplish something politically for Syria and politically for us. I've gotten to the point where I don't believe anything I hear, and all bets are off. Let me tell you about the case of the American citizen, Ahmed Abu Ali, who is a resident of Northern Virginia and whose parents contacted me a year ago when he was, he's an American citizen getting an engineering degree in a Saudi university. His parents are from Saudi Arabia. And, he was removed from his classroom by Saudi law enforcement, and he has been in solitary confinement in Saudi Arabia since June of 2003. As it turns out, we believe that the United States ordered him held for questioning in an Alexandria, quote, terrorism case of the Alexandria 11, which is truly the most tragic of all the terrorist trials that have taken place. Federal prosecutors from Alexandria, Virginia, actually went to Saudi Arabia to interview this man, the young man. The FBI interviewed him. Obviously, he had no connection with the Alexandria case, or they would have extradited him, because they extradited someone else from Saudi Arabia. This was a small, you know, small Muslim community of young men. Everybody knew everybody. And so anybody that knew anyone that the United States was prosecuting was under suspicion. Well, it's believed that Abu Ali, who has had no attorney, either Saudi or American, is being tortured. His family has had almost no contact with him. So finally, after the Alexandria 11 case was over and it was appearing that they were still not going to release him, his parents filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government for holding their son, saying that, now, you know, we know you're going to say he's in Saudi Arabia and outside government control, but using the cases of the Supreme Court decisions in June, said, you know, you have effectively ordered his detention. Up until that time, the United States was actually admitting that he was being held there for possible, you know, bringing back here for extradition. They couldn't say that anymore once that case was over. So the day the suit was filed, before that, there had been a series of phone calls in the week before, Saudi Arabia saying, we don't want your kid. As soon as the United States gives us the word, he's out of here. The United States saying, well, we don't want your kid anymore either, but the Saudis want him. Well, the day they filed suit in federal court in Alexandria, they got a call from the State Department saying that their son was being indicted on terrorism charges in Saudi Arabia and was facing, you know, the death penalty. For nothing. He's done nothing.
Vote Republican.
That's right, if that's what you want. So here, now, you know, my theory about that is that they kept him there. They didn't have anything they wanted to get from him. But there's no way the United States would let that man, that young man, see the light of day and be a witness to what happened to himself. And this is the thing I fear the most about people disappearing, that once you've come within the government net, and the reason why people disappear and don't come back is because you want to make sure that there are no witnesses to the crimes of the government. And I think that Americans who are at all critical of the Bush administration, if they're in any way an activist, I mean, I think they're at more risk by traveling abroad now than they are by staying at home. So keep your
our
eye
government
on that
could
case.
Just have a foreign government arrest you and send you off to Syria.
Absolutely.
Or Saudi Arabia for your rendition.
And did you read about a month ago there was a case, listen to this, where some Saudi Arabian citizens were they had permanent visas to live in Sweden. And the United States, for whatever reason, and this is a story in the Washington Post, these men had never been to the United States. The United States arranged for Saudi Arabia to kidnap the men out of Sweden. And they're now in prison in Sweden.
And the Saudis didn't have any reason to kidnap them except that we said so?
We said so. And the Swedes, I mean, there's a great uproar in Sweden about what happened here. And so who knows why they're there. But one of them has already been tried and convicted of some terrorism charges for 25 years.
My goodness. All right, it's the Weekend Interview Show. The guest is Elaine Castle. She's the author of the new book, The War on Civil Liberties. And it's the Republic Broadcasting Network. We'll be right back. All right, everybody. It's the Weekend Interview Show. For all you individuals out there to learn lots of things. The guest this hour is Elaine Castle. She wrote this great book. It's called The War on Civil Liberties, How Bush and Ashcroft Have Dismantled the Bill of Rights. And she's not kidding. And she goes through the book, not every single amendment, but the first, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, and the eighth. As we already said, the ninth and tenth never existed. And the Bush administration's violations of the Second Amendment are not necessarily related to their terrorism war. And the Third Amendment, of course, is kind of outdated. Quartering soldiers in our houses nowadays, they can just tax us and make us pay to quarter the soldiers down the block. No big deal there. Okay, now, here's the thing I want to cover with you, Elaine, and that is the Homeland Security Act. You write in your book that the devil is in the details.
Mm-hmm.
Most people think of the Homeland Security Agency as the people who come on TV every few weeks and cry wolf about some terrorist attack that never happens.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently there's actually some real dangers in this law and in this organization. Why don't you tell us about some of your concerns there?
Well, the Homeland Security Act certainly, reorganized the government and brought so many agencies under its umbrella, including, like, immigration and customs, and the opportunity in sort of creating new agencies, they were renamed, is to write hundreds of regulations that change the way these agencies function and carry out the law. And among them are rules relating, for instance, to the arrest of people charged with immigration offenses, that if it's remotely related to terrorism, there won't be any bail. There are all kinds of search and seizure things, regulations in there under the Transportation Security Administration, that most of us now just assume we do it, even though it has turned the Fourth Amendment upside down and on its head. So, for instance, whenever you are in any area that the Homeland Security Administration has declared an area of high alert, like several, I don't want to say square miles, I don't know how many areas of New York City right now and Washington, D.C. are under orange alert. By being in those areas, you have consented to be searched by any law enforcement person that's working under the, umbrella or protection of the Homeland Security agent. So in a sense, Metro Police, D.C. Police, New York City Police, they become agents of the federal government. And if you resist being searched, if you're walking down the sidewalk, it will be a federal crime. I mean, not going to be a state crime. The fact that any car that, drives through an airport can be searched now. So the search and seizure provisions are one thing. The fact of so many of the regulations are so secret that you won't even know they exist until you've been arrested for violating them. And the reason why, the secrecy, of course, which is just, you know, next to lying and secrecy got to be the two favorite activities of this administration, is that they say, well, we can't publish the regulations. Regulations for, you know, those who don't know are supposed to be public. They're supposed to be announced 30 to 60 days in advance. And then the formal final regulation is supposed to be published in what's known as the Federal Register, so the public has access to it. So in terms of, like, for instance, I know attorneys who
we're all out of time.
Well, the law is a secret, and you can't even find out what the law is.
Oh, nice.
How's that for America?
You're all in violation of it. The book is The War on Civil Liberties, How Bush and Ashcroft Have Dismantled the Bill of Rights. And check out Elaine Castle's blog, Civil Liberties Watch, at citypages.com. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Elaine.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, everybody. That was the Weekend Interview Show. Check it out at weekendinterviewshow.com. And if you want the old show, click on the old stuff at the bottom of the page there. You can email me, Scott@weekendinterviewshow.com. See you next week.